The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about Tom, episode 12 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. If you haven't listened to the episode we're going to be talking about, I strongly suggest you pause this podcast and go back and listen to episode 12. It is awesome. And then come back and listen to this conversation because we will still be here. We have a special guest joining us today. And our guest is Amber Hunt. She's an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and host of Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast on the Obsessed Network, and Accused, one of my all-time favorite podcasts for the Cincinnati Inquirer, for which she reinvestigates old cases in the search of new leads. Hey, Amber, it's great talking to you.
Hey, I missed you guys.
I miss you too, by the way. I should also mention Amber is also my real life friend. And of course, with us is Susan Simpson, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, a lawyer and super investigator and the lead on the Jeff Titus case. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
So, Amber, I understand you know a little bit about the Titus case. Can you tell me what you know and just give me your impressions of this case generally?
When the case was reinvestigated, I actually was kind of a green cub reporter in Michigan at the time. So I remember I was paying attention to it. And I was also very impressed that they could come up with an answer after so many years. But I was also covering my very first murder back then. And I was real stupid. So I've become a little more jaded in the interim here.
Just a little bit.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, Amber, your podcast, Accused, looks at cold cases, basically, and or cases that may have been, like, you know, taken wrong turns. And I don't know. I'm not sure what you're working on now, but I just would love your impressions about sort of reinvestigating a very old case. Susan has pointed out a few times in this podcast that it was actually the reinvestigation itself which kind of mucked this whole thing up because there was a lot of pressure on the cold case team to get it done. And they were perhaps going back to people and using techniques that weren't great a very long time after the crime happened. Do you think there is in some ways more risk when you're doing cold cases, or is it about the same?
I think there's definitely more risk because people's memories are faulty as it is. It's tough to get clear answers when you're interviewing them and something has recently happened to turn around and come back years later and then not, I mean, you cast a wide net, you ask for their memories, fine. But if you start to plant stuff, then it's really problematic. So when I'm interviewing people, I make a point not to contradict them, not to correct a false memory. I don't want to taint anything. I just acknowledge, like, you know, in my head, okay, so that's not right. So that means that some of this information might be faulty, but I'm not going to try and lead them in any specific direction. And I think that's really, really important. And it's it doesn't sound like that was taken into consideration maybe as much as it should have been here.
Or not at all, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying real hard to be diplomatic.
It is a hard line to walk, though. It's a very difficult line because you don't want to implant stuff, but sometimes you have witnesses you have to question about certain things you found. There's no way to do an interview or learn without to. So you have to find a way to ask that question without risking implanting the memory by doing so.
So tricky. So yeah. I am researching a new case for accused, and I'm like, I'm to the point where I've got thousands of documents I'm reading. My eyes are blurry every night. But I found this one woman who just flat out didn't remember anything that she had told police. So I forwarded her the document, you know, like the written statement part. I was comfortable doing that much. Like, you know, does this jog anything? But I wasn't going to say, you know, yes, but in this other report, so-and-so says that you saw this, and, you know, because then I don't know what's real and what isn't anymore.
Yeah. The absolute baseline is you can't make them think you want a certain answer. You can, if you have like conflicting information you have to question about, you can do that. But you can't, once you start sort of broadcasting that you're looking for something, they're going to piece that together and they'll be like, oh, I don't want to not remember, so I'm going to half remember. That sounds right. Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, it's really not that different from journalism, though, right, Amber? Because that's the same thing. You know, you want to just report. You don't want to report back, and then you have a feedback loop where you're.
Yeah,
that's why you don't let
loop.
Sources hear your story before you broadcast your story, right?
One time, I heard somebody in my newsroom go, "Well, why don't you just tell me something like blah blah blah?" And I just about hit the roof because we ethically can't do that, and it would be smart if that line of ethics were adopted in these interrogations with law enforcement.
Some witnesses are so easy to lead. You talk to them and you're like, oh my God, if I was unethical and a cop, I could make this one woman say anything. Like, because people, like, some, they're helpful. They're not trying to lie, but they don't want to get it wrong. I imagine like the type A in schools who are like never want to get an answer wrong when they're called on in class. So they'll kind of like tell you, not outright, but like, you know what they're asking, like, what should I be saying here? Like, what's the answer? Let me know so I can make sure I get it right. And like, that's not what I'm trying to do. Let's not do that. And there's no malice in it. There's just that they want to do the best job and help the most they can. But you can see how if a cop was talking to them, oh yeah, that story could come out any way they wanted it to.
It's interesting to me, and I think about this a lot, especially in this case, because this cold case unit was under pressure basically to preserve their own jobs in many ways. Not in many ways. I mean, they were. They said they had to solve this so they could keep their funding. And I think about, I mean, putting the state of journalism aside right now, I think about how, you know, full disclosure, some long form pieces are, parts of them are pre-written before you've done certain interviews. So you might have paragraphs that say, you know, quote from somebody here, and you might be thinking they might say something else. But the bottom line is, if you talk to them and they don't say that, you got to change your story. Like, you can't,
right.
You can't, like, you know, you write, that's how magazine articles are written, for instance. They're sort of blocked out and framed sometimes before you do even a single interview, but you have to change it. And the pressure isn't there ostensibly because if you have a good editor, that's what they would want you to do. And that seems to be where this breaks, because it's both the time pressure and, you know, as we've talked about many times before, in the criminal justice system, they want the win, right?
Right. Yeah. I actually, because of that, I make a point not to pre-write until I've done a good bit of the reporting legwork. I might not have done every interview, but I've read all the files or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
So, Susan, for full disclosure, I loved this episode that we're talking about this week because it takes on two of my favorite subjects, serial killers and the mythology around serial killers.
Well, it's so interesting, too, Rebecca, because this was probably the most true crimey episode I think I've ever written, or the most like traditional format true crimey, if that makes sense.
Well, and I know I think Rebecca's a super huge fan of profiling.
Huge.
Oh, yes. It's the best, isn't it?
It's a real science. It was so funny because let's talk about that. The FBI profile. Remind me first how the FBI got involved to begin with.
So Workema, the detective who was on the case the longest and was still on it by the end, he went to the FBI for help. I think it was actually the local FBI office near Kalamazoo. And they're like, let's go to the behavioral science unit in Quantico, Virginia, and get their input. So they send all the files and they send like a little checklist over. The cold case team fills out a checklist about Jeff Titus based on their impressions of his personality and fill it out for him, send it along with it. And then the whole cold case team, including one of the guys who got kicked off because they wanted to have him there as well, because he was friends with another detective who was there, They go down to Quantico. They sit around a table with all the PhDs. And in the end, the FBI is like, yeah, this is your guy. He fits the profile. Titus is.
Because I said yes to everything that you asked me questions about, right? They're sort of victims of the same thing. So let's talk about the profile that they came up with for the killer in this case. Because like you said in the podcast, I knew exactly what it was going to say before you even listed the things. An intelligent, loner, white male with hunting experience and a job. Can you just talk about that? Because that does seem to be, I mean, there's a prototypical profile, right?
It's the classic serial killer. It's the platonic ideal of a serial killer description. And in the end, a lot of it actually was right, which is not surprising, because this profile is really just kind of like a best guess. Like, here's what we know is often the case. Let's say that is the case here. So statistically, right, you're probably going to come out okay, but that doesn't mean that the profile itself had any sort of special insight, because it probably did not.
Amber, do you have an opinion about profiling? And see, just to be clear, my problem with profiling isn't necessarily the fact that it happens. It's how it's characterized. I don't like that it has been broadcast and basically branded to be this crime-solving tool when that doesn't seem to be why it was invented or what it's actually used for. But like in this case, the cops, like, they used it as a crime-solving tool, and that is problematic to me. What do you think, Amber?
I'm kind of in the same boat. I look at it sort of the same way I look at lie detector tests. It might be a useful tool, and I wouldn't discourage somebody from, you know, asking about it, but I would also keep in mind that it could be 100% wrong, because it's really, like, based on statistics and likelihood, and that's fine, but you know, the outliers exist, so you can't close your mind and just assume, okay, well then this is our guy. I find that a little concerning in the episode, that it went from, yeah, he's got an alibi, so he can't do, to FBI says it's him, so it must be.
Well, Amber, according to the cold case team, the FBI actually said, look at this photo of him, his face looks guilty. So
that is
facts. Yeah,
solid evidence.
yes, he looks the part. So let's talk about this guy Dylan. Really interesting story here. Did he fit the profile that the FBI came up with?
He does fit. Like, well, he was 42 when he was caught, but he, at least one of the kills, he was still in his 30s. Like the profile said, he is white. He did have a 9-to-5 job Monday to Friday. He had a wife. He was in fact a loner. He was above average intelligence, kind of basically what you expect. And this is why I don't like profiling, because it's indistinguishable from common sense. Like, look at this case, like, you're gonna, like, anyone with half a mind is gonna be like, okay, here's probably what we're looking at. There's nothing special or helpful about it. It's a place to start. You're probably not gonna look for someone who is wildly different from, like, those characteristics. But, of course, how do you define wildly different? Really what mattered here in this case, what solved the case, was when Richard Fry, his friend, saw it and realized the pattern fit what Dylan had told him he would do if he wanted to do murders, which isn't really a profile at all. It's just him stating what he would do. Then it does happen. He's like, let's put one together. Like, yeah, it could be Dylan.
Yeah, I was really interested on this, like, sting operation that they put in place following Dylan around. As we hear in the podcast, you know, surveillance is hard. And I think that we are often, again, trained to think it's easy, but they point out in the country it's especially hard. But really the ethical thing here, because they watched him do things that weren't great, and they were, like, kind of waiting for him to do what exactly? Actually kill somebody?
They were mostly watching him, one, to get evidence, but really it was to make sure he didn't kill anyone else, hopefully, because at that point they actually had no evidence. They didn't have anything, really. He looked really suspicious. He, you know, kind of fit what they were looking for, but they, in terms of evidence, they didn't have anything. They couldn't arrest him for that. They couldn't make a move. They were scared to interrogate him because he might be tipped off and, like, change his profile or whatever, change his habits. So really a lot of surveillance was like, okay, we really think it's him. We got no evidence. Let's make sure, to the extent we can, he doesn't kill anyone else while we're waiting for evidence.
But Amber, weren't you struck by the fact that, you know, Jeff Titus, as we've discussed many times in the show, is an odd guy. He does love hunting and killing animals in that frame, but I haven't heard any stories about him just killing animals for fun, you know, pets and so forth. Yeah. And I certainly haven't heard him committing arson. I mean, Amber, doesn't that strike you as like a different kind of person?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the guy who will shoot the stray dog just because he can is definitely a different kind of person than the one who goes out and shoots a deer and eats it.
What do you think, Susan?
There's a thing called the McDonald Triangle, which is discredited. It's not legit, but it is interesting in that it does have a recurring sort of a pattern, in that serial killers are described, you know, this is the outdated version of it, as people who kill animals for fun, do arsons for fun, and are bedwetters, or were bedwetters when they were children. And I don't know about Dylan bedwetting, but at least two of those three of the triangle here were definitely present, because he did this a lot. He killed thousands of animals. He caused millions of dollars worth of damage in burning barns, other buildings down. He was very destructive. That was his hobby, was like killing and ruining stuff. For Titus, that's how the cold case team tries to describe him a lot. They try to make him out to be this kind of like pathological character. But they're imposing that view on him. It's not actually coming from stuff he's doing. Like, he's a bit strange. He has some odd habits. He loves hunting. But he's not burning stuff down for fun. In fact, he plays cop for fun. He goes out and tries to find people, like the cows that he saw that were being mistreated. He instantly, you know, gets the authorities involved, reports it, does his own police report to call it in, because it's a crime. So he's, in that respect, he's very, very, very different from Dylan.
I would say it's an important PSA, though. If anybody has floated your name as a possible murderer, maybe don't joke that you committed those murders.
Yeah, maybe don't do that.
Definitely not. You know, another part of the profiling that has come up that is also not based in, you know, actual data, but just in sort of like anecdotal data, is that serial killers are adopted. Like, that's another one. Just FYI, you'll see these things over and over and over again. And, you know, it's not helpful.
Nope.
For sure. And it certainly discounts the fact that there are, and there have been, and there probably will always be, different kinds of serial killers that we're not looking at because of the limitations of this story around the profile.
Absolutely.
Remember, I think about that all the time. Like, I think about that prolific serial killer in California who, as it turns out, was black. They were looking for basically a young white person for decades. Guess what? And so, like, how many other people are out there who just don't fit this? And so we don't, you know, think to look there. Do you ever think about that?
I think, well, that guy is Samuel Little, and one of his unnamed victims is in my town, and I'm still hoping to figure out who the hell she is.
Which
he drew
one
a
is
picture
that?
Of her. Samuel Little, he killed a bunch of people in a bunch of different states, but there were two in Cincinnati. One, they figured out who it was, but the other one, we don't have a name. We just have his drawing and a general description.
That's right.
And every now and then when I'm feeling slow in my, you know, 14 jobs, I hop on and try and see if I can find any mention of a murder that fits that one, but we haven't found it yet. Mm. But anyway, yeah, I think about that stuff all the time. Also, it so happens we have this kind of little incestuous true crime world. I am reading a book for Toby Ball's Patreon book club.
My co-podcaster, yes.
And I made a point, because I have no spare time, to choose a case that I could also cover for Crimes of the Centuries.
Yeah, double dip, man.
That's how I roll. So Jane Britton is the case, and she was a 1969 victim near Harvard, and there were all of these great suspects around her, and it ended up being a freaking serial killer. And it's just you can't discount that as a possibility just because somebody ticks all the boxes, and just because statistically it's more likely that it is somebody who knows the victim, doesn't make it so, you know?
Yeah, Amber, I was hoping you're going to do the Dag Hammarskjöld case.
Uh-oh.
Which case?
The UN Secretary General who was strangely murdered in like the 50s.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a great case. I mean, it's an awful case, but...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm starting to get a little crass sounding. I'll add it to my list, though. I've got a
good one. Yeah.
That would be a really good one. So one of the things that was in the profile also, which I got a kick out of, maybe a little bit sadly and darkly, was that this killer was acting out from some kind of inner problem.
Yes.
No.
Yes. That is, you see that a lot in profiles too. And you're like, I mean, like when I demolish a pint of coffee ice cream, like, am I acting out of some, maybe I am, I don't know. But like, no, I'm doing this, I want to. Like, like I'm not doing that behavior because of some inner like turmoil. It's like, or I actually want that ice cream.
Slash, we do everything out of inner turmoil. You know?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right.
So like it's either
right.
not.
And we
or
do everything, yeah. And we do everything because of our messed up relationship with our parents. We don't all kill people, right? That's another one is like another thing that's part of the myth. You know, bad relationship with his mother. Okay.
Yeah, well, Dylan
show
did
me someone
it
who has a good
he was
one.
Born. Honest to God, I think that was a huge driver for him.
Really?
Yeah, because he was, you know, he had a kind of boring job. He actually majored in journalism in Ohio State. Ended up doing as a draftsman at the waterworks. Was apparently a bad, like a not bad employee, just kind of under-motivated. And on the weekends, when he was free, he would go around and do more exciting things.
He chose wrong. Journalism actually is, it's not boring, you know, for all of its faults, it's not boring.
Definitely not. But you don't get to burn anything, which apparently he was super psyched to do.
Yeah, he needs to combine those two interests somehow.
So how, Susan, did the profile shape their tactics in surveying him?
So I think Agent Trombitis did... I really respected the way he talked about this time and how hard it was and the difficulties they faced. And they all took it extremely seriously, obviously. And they were, I mean, I can't imagine a higher stress job where you're spend all your weekend time making sure a serial killer that you're increasingly convinced is a serial killer and isn't killing anyone else. But at the same time, it does seem like their expectations of what kind of killer he was, like what his MO was, did impact how they did surveillance. And they often would follow him from like 6 a.m. onwards. And then when he went home towards the later afternoon, they would assume he'd be in for the night because usually they saw he was. Like he would get home, you know, 2 or 3 or something and then not leave again. There is a good suggestion from the case file that's not always what happened, though. That he did, at least a couple times, actually go out again after. Hopefully, as far as we know, never killed anyone after that, but he was seen, or someone matching his description and his vehicle description was seen watching lone fishermen and hunters hours after surveillance stopped on him.
Yeah, I was really surprised to hear that, like, he would just shoot at people. And they would, I mean, that to me, like, broad daylight, right? Like, just, like, sighting people and shooting them. And then those that father and son that just ran away somehow and, like, didn't get shot. Like, what kind of, like, is there a profile, or I want to say the word profile, but is there a, you know, any kind of precedent or other kind of, like, killers or in cases I might know about where hunters in particular, outdoors people, were targeted?
There have been some. I would say for Dylan, I think part of the issue is that he actually was not a good shot, particularly.
Yeah.
So he, and also I'm sure the drinking all the time didn't help either, but he just wasn't that good of a shot. So he had some shots he, you know, made, but he did seem to have quite a few misses, which I think explains the father and son in Jefferson who saw someone like that and was shot at, but they got away. The guy who was shooting at them was not between them and the car, so they just kept running backwards and they were fine. But there are other people. It is not a targeting hunters is not a common MO for serial killers. It's not something that's happened a lot that we know of. On the other hand, it's kind of the perfect crime. Like if you don't screw it up by like writing taunting letters, how is anyone ever going to know the serial killer if you do it right? So it could be something that's just been overlooked. There have been instances, for instance, in Florida, there was a guy who killed several hunters for robbery purposes. He killed them and then robbed them. So that it's a thing that has happened. It's definitely not the common. Probably the most, obviously, the most high profile shooting is or similar shooting is the DC snipers, who kind of all over the country, really, but from, you know, from the south up till DC, Virginia, Maryland area, went on a crime spree for about 10 months, killed, I think, what, 10 people? Or 17? They killed a lot of people. And The profile there was very wrong.
Yeah, white, loner, neither were true, right?
Yeah, the Dylan case actually came up in the media a lot during this time period because they were trying to find like the most similar case they could. So people involved in the Dylan case did lots of interviews and were on Talking Heads on TV about it. And then it turns out that like actually it seems like a very different situation all around, even if the killings are superficially similar.
Amber, what did you think of this story that, you know, the people surveying Dylan actually saw him, well, they thought they saw him hunting somebody, basically, this female jogger who just happened to turn, what, left instead of right, and so sort of missed him as he was making the circle around. I thought that was frightening, but at the same time, I found myself wondering, is that something that they thought they were seeing because they were looking for it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's really tricky. It was a very cinematic scene in the episode. That was like edge of your seat kind of stuff. I mean, if you're looking for something that's going to certainly stand out, but there's a reason that they're looking at him. I mean, obviously he's not quite right. And so, you know, I'm glad they were on edge, because what if something, if she hadn't turned at the right moment, it doesn't sound good.
Well, what Trombitus wasn't quite explicit about, but what happened there is the surveillance ground teams had lost Dylan. It was the plane that found him, and the people in the cars are too far to help. So they're there. The plane is watching this play out and reporting it down, and they cannot stop it at that point.
Jeez.
But she turned and circled the block, and she was gone.
I mean, there's certainly nothing you can, but he's made it very clear that he's looking for opportunities, and that certainly seemed like it was a potential opportunity.
So now here's Jacinta's theory, and I think she's right. We were talking about it the other day. Dylan probably knew the teams were on him.
Why do you think that? Or why does she think that?
Because Trombitus is right. Like, the surveillance was so hard in the situation. It would have been very, very, very difficult to do it and have him not notice. And Dylan was not an idiot. He probably would have noticed that there were certain cars on these long backcountry drives where he often wouldn't see anyone. And the fact is, he did do crimes while the tails were on him. He shot at, like, you know, electricity meters and cars. But most of those crimes were done when there was ground surveillance. I think almost all of them were done when just the plane was watching, not people on the ground.
Interesting.
And the real serious crimes, not murders, hopefully, but the couple of arsons and like the cattle killings that were most likely him that happened during surveillance times, was when he'd shaken the surveillance altogether.
Ah, well, it does sound like he probably knew about it then. It's interesting to me that he's just the type of guy who just like takes off in the morning and just drives as his activity. You know what I mean? Someone like that probably would notice surveillance more than someone else. You know what I mean?
He was driving like 400, 600 miles a day. Then, like, he would just do cross-country drives all throughout Ohio that we know of, at least when the surveillance teams were on him, southeastern Ohio. And yeah, like, I think he probably would have caught on at some point.
So let's talk about the letter, because this is another very cinematic moment. Can you just remind listeners of this podcast what happened with this letter, who solicited it, and how did it come in?
So Jamie Paxton was Dylan's youngest victim. He was 21. He was out bow hunting, most likely, or just scouting an area for deer. And he was shot and killed. And there were no clues, like nothing to go on. And then a year later, this anonymous letter written on a typewriter comes into the local Belmont County newspaper. And it's a messed up. I put it on my Twitter feed if you want to go see it. It's kind of a messed up letter. It's totally a messed up letter. And the person is like saying, oh, don't worry that you couldn't solve this crime because I was too clever. Ha ha ha. And he is almost like not regretful or like kind of like feigns regret or sympathy. And he's like to the Jane Paxton's fiance, he's like, read this poem, it'll make you feel better. And he talks about how he's a serial killer and he can't stop himself. And then the law enforcement gets it and they're like, eh, it sounds fake to me.
I mean, is it? I mean, that's what I was wondering. Is there proof the letter is real?
That's a very good question. We'll have to wait for that one.
Oh, this is that there's importance there from what
I understand. It's a good question, yes. But yeah, the letter, I mean, one interesting part is that the letter does describe the killing in a way that's contrary to how the press reports were describing it and in ways that contradict what the law enforcement believed. And it does seem to me, based on what I have, like, it does seem like the letter writer had a better version of events than the actual law enforcement theory. Although it's hard to say because some of the records are missing now. Amber, by the way, Ohio is terrible.
Yes,
why is Ohio terrible?
Ohio is obnoxiously terrible. They just like they give zero fucks when it comes to FOIA stuff.
it's frustrating. I mean, I've dealt with worse. Virginia was a nightmare.
Oh yeah, I said too.
But you know, I just don't understand why the default isn't more information, not less.
Oh my God, Ohio, they don't care. And like I'll have two agencies. Like one of them has to have the records, and both be like, "Nah, we have zero records. They're all at this other agency." I'll go to them. They're like, "Nah, we have zero records. They're all with so and so." The same, like so, back and forth. And both of them like, "Well, can't help you. We have no records here." I'm like, someone has records somewhere. Y'all have to like, nope, we don't. We're just gonna say they're somewhere else. For instance, the DNR has zero. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which handled, game and hunting stuff and was heavily involved in the investigation, has zero Dylan records. Zero. Not a single paperwork in the entire DNR. Yeah, and even though the DNR was involved in the surveillance, involved in the task force, had a huge role in a lot of this, gathered a lot of important evidence, somehow today they will swear. Like, I talked to them on the phone and I'm like, what do you, like, how are you going to phrase, like, what is the answer here? Like, are you saying they were destroyed or that you can't find any? They're like, all we can say is that no such records exist in our possession.
Yeah.
Like, whatever.
You know, Amber, have you ever come up against this? Because New Hampshire's not great either. And I have often been finding myself wondering because some of the, you know, PIOs or whatever, public information officers in some departments or some agencies will just be really honest with you and say, like, we don't have an employee who can do this. So it's just going to take a really long time because I'm going to be doing it in my spare time between other stuff. So in some cases, there's sort of like an unfunded mandate here. It's the law, but there's no resourcing to actually back up the law to like make copies, redact things, all the things that have to happen. But in other jurisdictions, it just does seem like the policy is to ignore the statute. Is that what it's like in Ohio or is it more just sloppy, you guys think?
I would say sloppy. I think for them,
some of the Ohio agencies that I was talking to actually had people like assigned to this role. And as far as I can tell, their whole job description is to tell people we can't help you.
Really? They have people assigned to it? Yeah.
Well, so there's a case I'm working on right now where a lawyer was looking for some info. So she FOIA'd for it and they didn't have it. And then they gave her like a partial thing. And then she was slipped the info that she was looking for by like a friend of a friend. So I have seen in this state, just straight up bullshit avoidance of the law.
Yeah. The Ohio DNR is obviously lying. They obviously have files on Dylan, but
if they don't, then they should have some kind of paper trail on what happened to them because they existed at some point.
So they're straight up lying. It's easy. Like, I mean, I'm like filing a lawsuit would be the next step. But beyond that, they can just tell you, sorry, I'm not going to help. And most people are kind of the mercy of that.
Right. Yeah.
So I immediately had questions about whether or not the letter was real. But it seems like law enforcement took it seriously, right?
Not till initially. When the task force got involved, someone's like, oh, by the way, over in Belmont, we got this letter. And they're like, let's give that a close look. Can y'all send that in for like fingerprinting and whatnot? So then they took it seriously and they like, you know, pored over it for whatever details they could find. The letter writer actually sent a photocopy of the typewritten letter. So there was not like less chance. There was no like, well, DNA they didn't test for, but there are no fingerprints or anything. And they just couldn't really find much direct info. Now a lot of stuff in the letter actually does kind of match up with Dylan in interesting ways. We'll get more into that next episode. But yeah, like the why, if Dylan did write this letter, like the why still kind of mystifies me. Not that it matters, but it is strange that Dylan I mean, he doesn't express remorse. He doesn't seem to feel remorse, but he does take a special interest in Jamie Paxton. I don't believe his story that he was really upset when he learned how young Jamie was. Like, that's obviously...
Wasn't he baited?
Oh, the mother just kept... The mother kept writing, like, letters. She was like, I just want to find your... Like, you know, just... She was heartbroken and just constantly writing and trying to, like, get attention for the case and get people to look at it. And that seems to have, like, struck something in Dylan. He definitely... After his conviction, he talked to her on the phone a lot. Like, he was... I don't believe a story about remorse, but I do believe... I mean, it's clear he had some special interest in Jamie beyond his other victims. And he says it's because he didn't want to kill anyone below the age of, like, 35 or something. But that's BS.
Hmm. You've
lived, like, a long life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You've had plenty of time. So you have a note here about Jamie's grave that I'm really curious about. What is going on with that?
Yeah, so they... In the letter writer says, like, oh, I went to visit his grave and describes it. So he obviously did go visit it. And they started surveillance in the grave. And at one point, they get an unknown male figure who has, like, on a, you know, knit hat and, like, big aviator glasses, kind of a round face, kind of looks like Dylan, is at the grave, just staring at it mysteriously for a while, and then walks away. After they found Dylan, they were trying to show it was him. But it's not a great video footage. And, you know, some people who knew Dylan were like, it's him. And some were like, oh, it's absolutely not him. I kind of lean towards it's not him. Because it's not great footage. But, like, and Dylan says it's not him for what it's worth, which is nothing. But I have wondered, like, was there someone else who was mysteriously visiting Dan Paxton's grave that has no business to be there?
Oh, I mean, graves aren't secret. They're public, right? Amber,
that's
what
true.
Were you
going to
say?
Oh, But he certainly wouldn't mislead anybody. Dylan, yeah.
Oh, he would never lie.
No, never.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask.
That
yes.
In the last episode.
That was stunning to me that the reason they don't believe he committed the murders in your case is because he didn't lie and he confessed to others. To hear an FBI agent say that, that really surprised me. Susan, what did you think about when you heard that?
People believe Dylan. A lot of people who knew him and talked to him for some reason found they believed him. I think Trumbitis is, I was impressed with a lot of his investigations he'd done. Like, I don't think he seemed like a good investigator to me. He seemed like he was actually pretty on it. And I don't say that a lot. Like, a lot of times I'm pretty critical of police officers who may have noticed. but, like, he seemed like a good investigator to me. So it was even more stunning that he was like, yeah, I just believed him. Not just believed him, but, like, he honestly thought that Dylan wouldn't be lying to him.
Hmm. Did they specifically ask him about the murders? About
yes,
the murders
he says he knows
case?
Nothing about it.
Okay, so they
all the out-of-state ones he says he does not know about.
All the out-of-state ones. That's interesting.
One thing, though, that there's the father and son duo, who, and if that was Dylan, then that was a twofer. But
and
one of the reasons that...
Another twofer that same day, like 4 hours earlier, or 8 hours earlier, and a couple counties away, two people as well.
But that it was two people was one of the reasons that they nixed him from this case.
That's also why they ruled out the other incidents. They also ruled out the other incidents because there are two people.
Wait, explain that to me.
There's one more we'll get into next episode, but the only five cases that they decided were the serial killer were the five that Dylan ultimately pled guilty to.
Yeah.
And the other cases were ruled out because they don't match the MO of those five cases. But it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg problem there. How do you choose which are your core cases to extrapolate from?
Right.
So they were eliminated because there were two people in these other cases?
Yes. And they the ones, like, their core case, they start, like, the first five they found only involved one person. So they decided the serial killer, before they even knew who Dylan was, they decided the serial killer only attacked people who were alone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if that's what you decide, that's what you're going to see, right? That's a theme we get to over and over again.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this riddle that was called in.
So there was, in 91... It's still not clear if it was legit. The law enforcement seemed to think it was, and it might have been. And it wouldn't surprise me if it is legit. Dylan really did do it. But someone called in a riddle to law enforcement. And the only clues were, don't cry, and then, like, five words that are blanked out. So, like, don't cry, space, 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 space. And then the letters MF, JFK, and WVU. And the riddle ended with, solve this and you'll know my identity.
I'm looking at it right now. It's not Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
I know. I tried to make that work. The task force thought for a time that it was a prisoner in a West Virginia prison, and they had some complicated theory for it. Obviously, didn't check out. And I've stared at it. I've not spent a ton of time on it because very quickly I was like, okay, this is just the serial killer messing with us. So I have no idea if there's actually a riddle there or not, but maybe someone out there can crack it.
Now, as you point out in your notes, Susan, this is a question for Amber. Apparently, there are a lot of serial killers in southeastern Ohio specifically.
And Ohio in general.
Just like, what serial killers are you talking about? I don't think I'm familiar with all of these.
Oh, my God, all of them.
Okay,
they're all
which
there.
Ones? Go.
So in Stark County alone, where Dylan lived, there's at least four others. Kenneth Roth. I don't even know the names. Like, there's like just waves of serial killers. There's like the 77 killer, 71 killer. It's a lot of serial killers. And like trying to untangle like which crimes are which does not seem possible there.
We got a little crap from people who were like, with season one of Accused, we had a serial killer episode and they're like, oh, you're just, sensationalizing this. They had nothing to do with anything. No, dude, there are a lot of serial killers here. There's Nolan Ray George. There's the dude, the Casanova killer that I got a letter from in Florida. Samuel Little was here. All of these. I think there was like an Edward Edwards.
Oh, yeah. Eddie Edwards.
If you name your kid that, why would you name your kid that? I promise you he'll become a serial killer.
Yes.
It's amazing how many here versus other parts of the country.
I have a list somewhere. I don't have it memorized, but like when I'm trying to work on this case and find stuff, like it's just impossible to like do searches because you look for one serial killer, you're going to find 20 others that were active there. It is just an incredible number.
Jeffrey Dahmer. Let's see, from Ohio. Robert Bordella. I just found like you can Google.
Oh, yeah,
it's incredible.
Edwards.
Edward Edwards is that guy that the internet thinks like killed JonBenet Ramsey and a bunch of other people.
Oh, God.
That he could
oh,
not
it's that
have
guy.
Killed. It's that guy.
He killed everyone.
Yeah, there's a great podcast about him called The Clearing, which I really liked. Donald Harvey, Gary Heidnik, Michael Madison. Wow, there are a lot. And Anthony Sowell seems to be the one that everybody is talking about, known as the smelly guy. So what's in your water,
one.
Amber? What's going on up there?
Well, luckily, I'm a transplant, so I've only been here since 2013. I'm trying to make sure my child drinks bottled water.
So, Amber, we have one question from a listener. Before we get to it, I know that you know enough about this case and it sparked your curiosity. Do you have any questions for Susan about her investigation?
I think, just so you know, in case you're, because I'm always a little funny when the format changes, I find this season's format really fascinating. I like the dynamic between you and the others. I think I would like to know... did you end up learning anything about Dylan's wife?
Oh, yeah.
Will that come out?
I have questions about that, too.
I still have questions there as well, but yeah, we did speak to her.
Okay.
Really?
All right. I'm curious about that.
So, I guess a big question for me is, it might sound obvious, but I think there's more to it than this. Why did you do a whole episode about Dylan? Is it because you believe he committed these murders, or is it one of those cases where the cops should have looked at it and that proves that they sucked? Like, is it both? Like, which one is it, Susan?
It's because to understand how this case intersects with Titus's case, you need to have a grasp of what actually was going on with Dylan. So they did rule out Dylan as a suspect for various reasons, which we'll get into. And I think once you see what Dylan was actually doing, those reasons don't quite hold up. This episode's about what we know about Dylan, what was found about him in the investigation, what was going on. That was like the basis that investigators had to work from. And to me, the jump that they took to go from that to say that Dylan could never have done the other cases that he was suspected in but didn't confess to is tenuous.
So what to what Rebecca's saying, then, there's a reason that you're spending as much time on him as you are.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, too, because this comes up a lot in other cases where it's like, I mean, let's just assume for a second, Amber, that like he may have done it, right? So how many times have we heard stories where somebody was maybe wrongfully convicted and there's like, also, by the way, there's an active serial killer in the area killing people a lot like the victims in this case. And then the response always seems to be like, but what are the chances that that serial killer also killed this person? I'm like, I don't know. Pretty freaking good. They're out there like killing people. Am I crazy to think like maybe the whole what are the chances ... around serial? I mean, what are the chances that I'm going to get killed by a serial killer? Like zero. But what are the chances that an active serial killer in a geographical region killing people who matched my victim also killed my victim? That seems like an absurd question to me. What do you think, Amber?
In statistics apply to every victim. The one that I will always think about is Georgiana Hawkins, Ted Bundy's, one of his victims. She was walking. It shouldn't have happened, but guess what? It did, because statistically it doesn't matter once it's happened. I don't understand holding on to likelihoods when, you know, you already have proof that something is happening. Then all of the normal stats are thrown out the window. You have to look at it more, okay, but we do have a serial killer in this area. Yeah. So isn't that a new set of numbers, I would think?
Most killings are not serial killings, obviously, but serial killings do tend to result in crimes that are very hard to solve and often bizarre. And I think it's not unreasonable to expect that they'll be statistically more common in these kind of older cases or these more complicated cases than in the general, you know, set of murders overall. And so for me, Sam Little, and I'm still interested in this, I am just waiting for more stories to come out of people who are wrongfully convicted of murders that Sam Little did, because that seems like the exact setup that you like. It's the perfect setup for people to be wrongfully convicted. Like, you know, crimes that look personal, women strangled. How many, like, ex-lovers or, like, you know, male acquaintances have gone down for those crimes that we don't know about yet, that Sam Little did?
I mean, yeah. That was a small aside in Serial as well, right? I remember Deirdre Enright saying that there was an active serial killer in the area that was killing young Asian women when Haman Lee was murdered, and it was just ignored. And it's not like that's definitely what happened, but it shouldn't be ignored either, right?
Yeah, that is, I'm not saying just he was connected or he was involved, but there's a big story with that guy that has never really come out, and not necessarily about Haman Lee, but about other cases as well.
Yeah.
And again, they're like, ah, whatever, serial killer doesn't happen hardly ever.
But one of them kills a lot of people. So it's like,
yeah. But you also have, so one thing I've kind of realized working on this case is that serial killers are actually way more common than I realized.
Yeah.
And that there's tons and tons more of people, serial killers who are just nameless because they only got, you know, like three or four before they got caught or they gave up. Otherwise, like, we know the big names. We assume that's like all there is. But there are so many serial killers that no one's ever heard about.
Yeah. Absolutely. And probably a lot more out there that haven't been caught yet, which is a very comforting thought. So,
yeah, sleep well, everybody.
It's like growing up in the 70s and 80s where we're all sure we were going to get kidnapped or killed by a serial killer. Now, we don't want to bring that back because, you know, it's probably not going to happen to you. So Anne S. from Twitter, also a fan of my podcast, hello, Anne, asked a similar question to the one Amber asked before, but I just want to underline it and give her a little bit of air to ask it. She says, so the conclusion that the known serial killer of Hunters did not do these murders came down to believing the serial killer? Susan, that is what happened, right?
That is, in fact, what happened. In the face of evidence that might suggest there was more reason to look at him, even, it was Dylan's denials that kind of dictated where the investigation went.
Jeff Titus also denied he did it. Why doesn't he get more credit for that?
Because his face looks guilty.
Because he looks like a liar.
Yeah, see, right, Dylan, he's camouflaged. He looks all normal and happy family life. And whereas, you know, Dylan or Titus is, I mean, he had family. Titus had two little girls. He had a job.
I know, and a wife.
But he was weird, so.
Who later ran away with his defense investigator.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Sorry.
Did you know that, Amber?
No, I missed that one.
Yeah, Jeff Titus's wife got together with his defense investigator, and they went to prison, or they went to the jail together to tell him that she was breaking up with him and getting together with a defense investigator.
I'm so excited. So because I've been doing all this other stuff, I've been catching up. I'm so glad I was at because I started catching up, and this case is bonkers.
Yeah.
There was one thing though. I have never been able to figure out why it is that you will have a killer comfortable admitting to some crimes, but then they draw the line at certain crimes. And that's the thing that I can't like wrap my head around. Like, well, I did that, but I wouldn't do this,
right.
You know? And so he didn't cross state lines because apparently that would.
That's interesting. That's an interesting detail because they're like the cross jurisdictional denial. There might be something to that. What do you think, Susan? Like,
I think next episode will cover a lot about that. Actually, I was talking to a psychologist who, you know, interviews people on trial for murders, often serial killing murders. And it was not about the Dylan case specifically, but he's talking about other people we've talked to. And like, he's like, oh, they never, like, it was interesting to me, they never admitted it. And like Gacy, for instance, like to the end, like never would outright admit what he did. And he thought it was a method of control in a way. Like, it's his little secret against the rest of the world that he can always hold on to when he's in prison, right. And can't hold on to much else.
Yes. And there's like 100 million bodies under his house.
Which... Yes. And he's like, oh, I'm going to be like the advisor on how to, you know, find serial killers, the FBI. But I'm never going to admit that I did it myself.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, boy. All right, Susan, what's coming up next on the next episode of Undisclosed?
More about Dylan, but this time as it relates to how the Tyrus investigation played out.
All right. Well, Amber Hunt, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. What should we listen for that you are producing right now? People listening to this podcast can go listen to you doing, like on the podcast app.
Crimes of the Centuries comes out every week. So that's the one where you can get something fresh from me. I'm working on Accused. I'm hoping, I'm saying it here. I haven't even told my bosses. I think the fall is safe.
Nice.
I'm hard at work on that, but these I think like Monday's episode of Crimes of the Centuries is Richard Speck. It's Ooh. Just been super fascinating figuring out how these different cases that, you know, you might have heard of but you don't know all the details to, how they ended up really affecting, you know, society and the legal system and all this stuff. I've been having a lot of fun light word for investigating murders, but it has been really interesting to research.
Well, I'm going to check out the Speck episode. Of course, he was one of the people profiled for the original behavior analysis unit's profiling techniques. If you watched Mindhunter, you get to see Richard Speck in Mindhunter a lot.
In my I always have these little like citations at the end, and I was like, and I learned that pretty much everything from Mindhunter is true. Like,
yes.
They were spot on.
Wasn't Richard Speck the one who read audiobooks in prison too? Was he that one?
I don't remember that, but he was the one who had the pet bird.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was real.
Wow. All right. Well, Amber Hunt, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on the Addendum to talk about this case.
Thank you for having me. I love talking to you guys.
And Susan Simpson, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I can't wait to hear next week's episode.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum. We will be back next week. If you have a question for us or tips about any of the cases covered on the podcast, you can email them to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them to us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just look for Undisclosed Pod. Audio production of the Addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. Follow the show on social media. Do it at Undisclosed Pod. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review and pop culture podcast, Crime Writers On. For everyone at Undisclosed, have a great week. Look forward to talking to you again.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.